Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is now or never. And there's so much I could just dive into, complain and rant and so forth. And as a matter of fact, I'll probably do that a little later because our schedule is a little bit different this week. And so we've got Paul for today and tomorrow. So let's welcome Paul back. Welcome back,
hey,
Paul.
Hey, thanks, GR. Glad to be back.
And glad to have you. And what I wanted to do was I kind of wanted to talk about what Mr. Wilson was talking about here. Mm-hmm. And so because what I'd rather do is start off from where we just picked, you know, where we picked up on Mr. Wilson's comments at the very beginning of his comments. That way we can kind of cover through this because he goes through a few different points here. And so when we hit four, when he talks about the magistrate, I'd like to dive into that. And so let's go ahead and read on, my friend.
So I'll read through number four.
Yeah.
And then we'll stop and discuss it, right?
You bet. Thanks.
Okay, here we go. Mr. Wilson entered into a contrast of the principal points of the two plans so far, he said, as there had been time to examine the one last proposed. These points were one. In the Virginia plan, there are two, and in some degree, three branches of the legislature. In the plan from New Jersey, there's to be a single legislature only. Two, representation of the people at large is the basis of the, one, the state legislatures, the pillars of the other. Three, oh, I see, I misread it. It was representation of the people at large is the basis of the one, the state legislatures, the pillars of the other. Three, proportional representation prevails in one, equal suffrage in the other. Four, a single executive magistrate is at the head of the one. A plurality is held out in the other.
Okay, so right there, actually I'm going to go back a couple points. And as he starts talking about this, he kind of points out that, you know, there are the legislature in the Virginia points. He's actually talking about Congress, that he's looking at three, in some degree, branches of the legislature. And then the New Jersey plan, there's a single legislature only. And the second point is representation of the people at large is the basis of the, and actually that is the apportionment of the population. In other words, it's, mm-hmm. you know, it, each state will get a representative based on a level or a census of population. We know that that came out to be 30,000 in the Constitution. And then he says, and the equality of suffrage in the other. Now, why didn't he use suffrage for the other house?
Okay, let me see.
This is point three.
Okay.
Yeah.
Representation of people at large is the other state legislatures, the pillars, proper representation, one, equality of suffrage in the other. The term is equality the key word here, equality of suffrage?
So the key word is suffrage.
Right. But proportional, what they wound up getting was proportional, because they're talking about the states, proportional representation and equality of suffrage. That's what we wound up getting.
Yeah, right? Yeah. So,
and but, he's saying,
but what, that, what I'm trying to really drive at is, okay, so what is suffrage?
It's the ability to, it's votes.
It's voting, right?
It's voting.
It is the privilege and opportunity to have your voice heard in a vote or casting, you know, for, you know, also suffrage is not a direct thing. And right. in a Republican form of government, suffrage is done by your representatives. But the reason I was pointing this out is he really emphasized suffrage in the Senate, but there's equal suffrage in the House of Representatives. Mm-hmm. Because it's based on, you know, it's still based on apportionment. So the apportionment is every 30,000. And so for the most part, everybody still has an equality of suffrage in the state as well as across the nation. Mm-hmm. But that's done based on an equality of people, where in the Senate, it is based on the equality of states. In other words, mm-hmm. the suffrage, who has their voice or who is being voted for, and it's the people in the one. And this is the hard thing that people don't understand. It is the state legislature that has the vote in the Senate. The mm-hmm. senators are merely representatives of what those state legislators want.
Right.
And so I wanted to point this out because I really, and I know you're reading the article, Why Counties Matter Most, mm-hmm. but I'm hoping that I really clarify this so that people really get this, you know, because the Constitution has not changed regarding suffrage.
Right.
The 17th Amendment only changed the mechanism of how senators were to be chosen. It did not take away the right of suffrage for the state legislature. However, the Senate has completely turned their backs on the states. Completely.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so every time the state legislature reaches out to their senator, and the senator actually does not respond, then the state actually has, or the state legislature, I believe, has more than enough a justification in recalling and pulling back that senator.
Correct.
Because he is not a representative of the people. The people have their representative in Congress.
It's so misunderstood.
Yes.
That it's rampant, and it's been intergenerational. So, you know, it's going to be, to bring this out, it's going to be a shock. But let me tell you, I think this is a good time to shock people. Let me tell you what I mean. We've already been, the last 3 years have already shocked us, okay? So I can't think of a better opportunity to shock people into the realization that the Constitution means what it says, and we can enforce it.
Right. So let's move into the next one now, because you just
right.
you
got next one's number four.
Number four.
Okay.
He talks about you've
about
already read
a single
this.
Executive magistrate at the head of one, a plurality is held out in the other.
Okay, so how is that so when we already heard that there was going to be a Supreme Court and an executive? Mm-hmm. Now, is he telling us that the magistrate is, you know, not including the Congress, or is he telling us, because actually, you know, the single executive magistrate is basically like Continental Congress, where it is just a body of representation.
I'm wondering if he's using that term loosely, and because they've been using the Continental Congress, that's just in his head. Because when you tend to attack the term magistrate,
uh-huh.
and I think it's because what it actually represents in Britain. So remember, these folks are not that far removed from Britain, and the term magistrate is in their lexicon.
Yeah, but they equally attack the concept of the magistrate of Britain or the monarchs and so forth. I mean, mm-hmm. they were... You know, they thought it was just absolutely evil. And so my point is, and actually what I wanted to get you to think about is when the framers talk about the sovereigns in our government, who are those?
Well, I believe that those sovereigns are the legislators.
Yes. Okay. So now that we understand in their context who are the sovereigns, then when you look at the term the magistrate, because the magistrate even represents a sovereign.
Okay.
So I actually believe he's talking about the plurality of Congress, not the judiciary and the executive.
But he used the term executive magistrate.
I understand that. I do understand that. But okay. I believe that when you really look at the people who have the authority to make law, and, you know, based on the Virginia plan, where did the magistrate come from? And based on the Continental Congress, what was the difference between the magistrates in the Virginia plan as the current Continental Congress and the executive there? What's the difference?
Okay. And the current Continental, you mean the Continental Congress as it stood before the Constitution?
Yes. So remember, John Hancock was the president of Continental Congress, but he was an administrative president. His role was administrative.
Correct.
In other words, he really had no say, because just to be clear, they hadn't started talking about the Electoral College yet. And just to be clear, at this point in time, I believe if you go back to the Virginia plan, I could be wrong on this, but the Congress was the one to select the president as well, not the people.
Okay.
And that principle changed as they went through this long process of discussing how to make this better and better, which is why they want to introduce the Electoral College, and because they talk, and we'll get into it, but they talk about direct elections and, you know, the importance of this indirect selection of the president via the representatives of the people, the electors, and so forth. And so I honestly believe at this point in time, that president that is being chosen by Congress is really, you know, just an administrative president and not the president that we have today that actually has, you know, all of these defined roles. Because, you know, if you go back to the Virginia plan, they didn't define a lot of the roles. They just kind of laid out an overview.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if we go back up, I mean, it was barely maybe a page and a half of what Governor Randolph covered.
Mm-hmm.
It was pretty, I mean, you know, the Constitution is pretty condensed and very to the point. And it was, Governor Randolph wasn't that good. And so my point is, I truly believe that when he's talking about a single executive magistrate, but he's talking really more about the defined plurality of Congress.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That's my perspective. Like I said, I could be wrong on this, but you know, this is where you really start. You have to understand, and you got it, but most people don't understand that our representatives are our sovereigns.
Well, so I wanted to get back to that also, because here's a question I can see being asked. Why are they sovereign? Their sovereign is actually, we lend that to them to cast their vote on our behalf. Okay, so we lent them that sovereignty to do their job in a very specific manner outlined in the Constitution. Outside of that, right, they don't have sovereignty, right?
Yes, so
they don't have authority to operate outside of the limited sovereignty we give them. Am I getting that right?
Yes. And so, in other words, with the way our government works, it's like a power of attorney.
Mm-hmm.
And if you understand that we delegate to an agent the power to, you know, to do things on our behalf.
Mm-hmm.
The big difference, and they dive into this because most people do not get this. that we do not have general powers of attorney. When we grant the delegation of power to our representative, whether that's at your county, whether that's at your state, or whether that's at the federal level, we have a constitution that contains them. We have a constitution that specifies what they can do in our behalf and only those things.
Right.
None of our constitutions were designed with general powers.
Correct.
None of them. And so I'm just trying to emphasize this big time, this concept of sovereignty and this concept that these men are sovereigns, which really it challenges a lot of people's heads because no, either the people are sovereign or God's sovereign.
Right.
In a Republican form of government, we are actually empowering and delegating, just like almost making them a king, but they're not a king of all things. They're a king of the few things we empower them. It is ludicrous to think that we, the people, could actually have, you know, a rational process of declaring war. We had to delegate that specifically to Congress, and only Congress has that authority where the states and counties don't.
Right. I think the way to refer it is they're sovereigns in the fact that there are lawmakers. They make the law. You know, the king was considered sovereign because the law came from the king. All right. And so we empower them to make our laws. And then through the representative process, those laws are reviewed and then, you know, accepted or not accepted. But that's, I think, kind of the way the system is supposed to work, right?
Yes. Yeah. And well, so they don't have privilege. And as I kind of also lecture people about politics, you know, politics is the art of compromise. And so the only compromise that our sovereigns have are over those things delegated. In other words, the decision of going to war is a compromise between factions that we've delegated power to. Now, today, okay, it's very clear that the factions have lined up as parties, and within the parties, there are sub-factions.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have delegated this power for them to play politics on these specific issues. This is why I say, you know, that politics, you know, open politics does not exist in the United States. It outlaws that. It outlaws this concept of, you know, people in government, your legislators, being able to just pass any law. And as a matter of fact, this is just running roughshod over everybody. Seriously. I mean, we're in a very, very bad situation because our state legislators and even our county legislators, our commissioners, what have you, believe that they have general powers, or they just do what they're told, you know, and from somebody that believes they have, you know, general powers and
right,
tells them, yeah, you have all the power to do this. But technically, at the county level, we don't have any protection because we never instituted a constitution for our counties, where we would actually contain our county government based on the powers delegated. We never did that. That's why it's so important.
Say that one more time. I had an interruption, so
that's okay. So the principle that I drive home in the Why Counties Matter Most is this principle that we, the people, institute government, and we have the power to alter or you know, destroy it if necessary. And bottom line, if we don't institute our government and we just have good people that step up and govern for us, like at the county level, because even though we kind of instituted that government, we did not formally do so with the Constitution. And so because we use constitutions to basically, you know, grant very specific powers, we have to actually go back, and this is why county constitutions and having county constitutional conventions is really, really critical. And this is where the county has to really, you know, excuse the expression, come to Jesus on mm-hmm. what powers they want that government to possess. And then once they figure that out, then they can go to the state and realign the state based on the powers they want their county to have. If they want their county to not be involved in their healthcare choices, nor any government above them to have those powers, then, and that actually becomes a standard in the Constitution across the state, then this is where, by having the state constitutional convention to say, we do not delegate to you any, or actually, the very first thing that you'll put in that state constitution is powers not delegated to this state are reserved to the counties of this state and the people. And that's it. And then you delegate what powers, and then when, you know, they go, hey, hold on here, you didn't delegate power for us to do you know, healthcare. You didn't delegate power for us to regulate energy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, then the state will actually kind of point out, oh, you know, there's some energy that you know, is an open market commodity, but there's other energies like your power that you can't. And so, okay, the counties come back and go, you know what, we need to amend the Constitution quickly. But what we want to do, and this is where it really boils down to, saying that there can be no more public utilities, that the electrical grid is a responsibility. We want elected people to be accountable, and then the counties will set up the strategy. You know, so in other words, leaving the county with the overview power to make sure that the needs of the county are being met equally. And that's how you can basically, you know, start delegating and confining things. And okay, you don't give them any power over medical or healthcare or, you know, those types of things. Education. This is where we peel back education. This is where we peel it all back so that we no longer have a central controller that wants to inject, you know, drag queen, you know, drama and crap into your classroom.
Mm-hmm.
There we go. Anyway. So go ahead, and we got about 2 minutes left. So go ahead and finish this paragraph.
We're at number four.
Yeah,
Okay.
Starts with five.
Five. In the one, the majority of the people of the United States must prevail. In the other, a minority may prevail. Six. The national. We need to touch this one. Okay. Number five. Legislature is to make laws in all cases to which the separate states are incompetent, and in place of this Congress are to have additional power in a few cases only. Seven, a negative on the laws of the states in place of this coercion to be substituted. Eight, the executive to be removable on impeachment and conviction in one plan, in the other to be removable at the instance of majority of the executives of the states. Nine, revision of the laws provided for in one, no such check in the other. 10, inferior national tribunals in the one, none such in the other. 11, in the one jurisdiction of national tribunals to extend, etc., and appellate jurisdiction only allowed in the other. 12, here the jurisdiction is to extend to all cases affecting the national peace and harmony. There, a few cases only are marked out. 13, finally, your ratification is in this to be by the people themselves, in that by the legislative authorities according to the 13th Article of Confederation. So probably, let me read this next one. With regard to the power of the convention, he conceived himself authorized to conclude nothing, but to be at liberty to propose anything. In this particular, he felt himself perfectly indifferent to the two plans.
Okay, so we really don't have time until we come back to talk about some of these parts of these plans. As I can say, we're going to go into a break right here. And so as I see it, what we've got to do is, or what we're looking at, these were proposals. Again, they hadn't really, I'll just say, galvanized. They haven't coagulated, congealed, whatever. They haven't really come to, you know, the full understanding where everybody was on the same boat or on the, you know, on the same page, I should say. But bottom line, we'll pick this up real quick so that we can move on. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on Reclaiming the Republic. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so anyway, let me get you back onto this. So I know you wanted to bring up a couple of points, but again, like I was saying, some of this stuff hadn't really come together yet. Like, this was just a concept, and as a matter of fact, going into the amendments of the Articles of Confederation, that was one of the things that they actually tried to seek an amendment for. Do you remember that? Where they're talking about, you know, where the states may not be competent in legislating certain things.
I remember we covered that word competent a couple of times.
Right. Okay. And or incompetent. And so right. They were really talking about their incompetency, I believe, for the most part, regarding trade and or currency value, things like that. So this kind of game, if you really look at where the federal government's primary powers are, it's really for taxation, and it's to regulate commerce from external into the United States. It is to be the traffic cop of regulating commerce among the states, not to regulate, you know, every nitinoid and every ounce to the, you know, to the gram or even a grain of sugar or anything like that. It was, as it says, to regulate commerce among the states, not mm-hmm. between the states, not within the states, among them, and regulate commerce with the Indian tribes. So as they go through, and this is what kind of jumps out to me, as they were going through the enumerated powers, they did have some special things that they didn't probably think, and this is where they thought that the states were incompetent in establishing a standard law or a uniform law on bankruptcy, mm-hmm. creating a standard of controlling copyrights and patents for a limited time. Those few things that they threw in there that they thought that, you know, it wouldn't be right for the states to do.
Okay.
And so, anyway, did you have any other questions regarding this?
So what I was looking at was something got my attention in number 5. In the one, the majority of the people of the U.S. prevail. In the other, the minority may prevail. Okay. This, what they said here, in the one, a majority of the states may prevail. In the other, a minority may prevail. I think this... Does this have to do where they were having the argument about suffrage in terms of
the people? Right.
The people.
Yes, because giving representation in Congress based on the apportionment of people per representative, to where there would be the bigger states that would have a real majority. But actually, when you really think about it, even though Virginia was the big state at the time, they were so unique that could they actually get all the other big states to join in to actually dominate the little states? I don't know if Pennsylvania was, you know, sycophants to Virginia, nor I don't believe any of these states, like Massachusetts, was sycophants to any other state. Does that make sense? In other words, I don't think there was any there. But I
maybe
do
maybe not at the time.
No, maybe not at the time, but I do understand that going from, because the minority prevailing is literally where an individual state could stop, because it was disclosed, I believe it was disclosed in the Virginia plan, that it was going to move away from unanimity that would, you know, require all states to buy into any type of change. That was the death nail that they put into the Articles of Confederation. And so now they're talking about where, you know, in that case, one state could actually prevail. In this state, a majority of states could prevail, but it would be a supermajority. So I think there's those connotations that, you know, they hadn't hammered out yet, but they were talking in a big level, or I should say at a high level, of each of these issues. So anyway.
Okay. I just... curious to know.
All right. Yeah. And I really wanted to go back through this, and we didn't have a chance to do that. So, all right, let's move on to the next paragraph and catch up to where we were.
Okay. Let's all right. see.
With regard to the power.
Yeah. With regard to the power of the convention, he conceived himself authorized to conclude nothing but to be at liberty to propose anything. In this particular, he felt himself perfectly indifferent to the two plans. So apparently he just laid out what they were dealing with.
That's it.
But it was Madison's perception that he was indifferent to the two plans. He just wanted to clarify how they stood out. Okay?
Right. Yep.
So with regard to the sentiments of the people, he conceived it difficult to know precisely what they are. Those of the particular circle in which he moved were commonly mistaken for the general voice. He could not persuade himself that the state governments and sovereignties were so much the idols of the people, nor the national government so obnoxious to them as some suppose. Hang on a minute. So he says the state governments and sovereignties.
Yep.
Who's he referring to?
So the sovereignties were, you know, I would just say, he could not persuade himself that the state governments and sovereignties were so much of the idols of the people, nor the national government. So the state governments, because the state governments did have governors, but I believe the sovereignties, he's talking about legislators. That was pretty interchangeable, that sovereignties or sovereigns were legislators, those who created law. But I think he's really talking about, you know, who actually had, you know, the people's, who did the people adore more than, you know, the national government or a state government? Now, to be honest, you've heard me say this, that the states have always been bad players.
Okay.
And so I don't think that the people were really enamored that much by their state. And, you know, actually having a national government a little bit to kind of keep the states in line somewhat was, I'm going to say, kind of appealing.
Okay.
Anyway.
All right. So, all right. Has it less dignity? Will each citizen enjoy it under it less liberty or protection? Will a citizen of Delaware be degraded by becoming a citizen of the United States? Where do the people look at present for relief from the evils of which they complain? Is it from the internal reform of their governments? No, sir. It is from the national councils that relief is expected. For these reasons, he did not fear that the people would not allow us into a national government, and it will be a further recommendation of Mr. Randolph's plan that it is to be submitted to them and not to the legislatures for ratification. Here's what I'm getting for them, is that his sentiment was that the people trusted the national government more than their states. Is that what he's saying?
I believe he's alluding to that, but we're not sure if this is just a contrasting or if this is, you know, his opinion, because remember, he said that it seemed like he was indifferent.
Right.
Okay.
Right. Okay. proceeding, and again, these are perceptions of Madison that he is writing here.
Yes, correct.
Okay, so this is how he sees what's being said.
Right.
All right, so proceeding now to the first point on which he had contrasted the two plans, he observed that anxious as he was for some augmentations of federal powers, it would be with extreme reluctance indeed that he could ever consent to give powers to Congress. He had two reasons, either of which was sufficient. One, Congress as a legislative body does not stand on the people. What's that mean? Okay. And two, it is a single body. He would not repeat the remarks he had formerly made on the principles of representation. He would only say that an inequality in it has ever been a poison contaminating every branch of government. In Great Britain, where this poison has had a full operation, the security of private rights is owing entirely to the purity of her tribunals of justice, the judges of which are neither appointed nor paid by a venal parliament. The political liberty of that nation, owing to the inequality of representation, is at the mercy of its rulers.
Right. Okay.
Okay. It's a mouthful.
Questions?
So, you would not repeat, just a minute.
Okay, so...
He said it would be with extreme reluctance, indeed, that he could ever consent to give powers to Congress. Okay? So, he observed that anxious as he was for augmentation of federal powers, it would be with extreme reluctance. So, it's, on the one hand, it's in the previous paragraph, he said, it sounded like Madison got the perception that the people were more inclined to a federal government, and then... In the next paragraph, he says, it's with extreme reluctance that he could ever consent to give powers to Congress.
Yeah, okay? But I believe what he's talking about isn't the people, it's the state legislators.
Mm. Okay.
Right. Because he's talking further down, Congress as a legislative body does not stand on the people.
Okay.
Right? And then he actually says, indeed, that he could... ever consent to give powers to Congress, he had two reasons, either of which was sufficient. One, Congress as a legislative body didn't stand with the people. So I believe he's looking at, you know, maybe these contrasts and comparisons. Maybe he was talking, you know, here about both the people as well as the legislatures. But I believe the framers, they kind of concluded, which is why the Constitution went to the people, to delegates, not to the people per a democracy, but mm-hmm. to a convention by the people, where the people sent their delegates. And actually, when we look at the time, it was always the same names. I mean, okay, the guys that didn't make it into the state legislature that year, they were the mm-hmm. ones that were available to attend the Continental, or I should say the conventions, the state convention on ratifying the Constitution. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
I mean, the political people were, you know, the same people that just kind of went through this revolving door. So in some states, they tried to make sure or limited how many state legislators could actually attend the Constitutional Convention.
Mm-hmm.
And in other states, they, you know, it seemed like they just appointed themselves how they wanted to do it. But, you know, that's how the people selected it. And
right.
either way, they left it to the people to choose who they were going to delegate their power to debate the Constitution. So bottom line, I think that they realized that the state legislature was far more jealous of surrendering any power at all to a general government than they were, you know, than the people were. And that the
right.
people would be more prone and more objective in looking at and debating, supposedly, the Constitution. But as I'm saying, it was really the same people. And maybe it was the divine hand of providence that everything happened to come to be, where the people in the state cabals were actually in office at the time.
Okay.
And that the people that were more available to actually be able to be delegates to that debate on the Constitution and that convention, maybe that was the, you know, it just laid out because it was unanimous.
Wow.
Does that make sense?
I know.
So anyway, I you'd have to really look at who all the players in politics were at the time, but I know that they were much of the same names. When you read through the delegates, because they list the delegates' names in the ratification debates, you go, oh, well, you know, this guy was in Congress, or, you know.
Right.
It was the same people, it seemed like.
Okay.
It's just that it was a different, it was either the bench, or, you know, when you look at who's sitting on the bench in the game.
Right.
It was the bench players that made it into this, and maybe, you know, they took it more seriously. But you still had key stars like Patrick Henry. He got his butt in there.
Right.
And so, anyway. All right, so we've kind of caught up to where we are, so go ahead and keep moving on.
Okay. He means not to insinuate that there is any parallel between the situation of that country and ours at present, but it is a lesson we ought not to disregard that the smallest bodies in Great Britain are notoriously the most corrupt. Every other source of influence must also be stronger in small than large bodies of men. When Lord Chesterfield had told us that one of the Dutch provinces had been seduced into the views of France, he need not have added that it was not Holland, but one of the smallest of them. There are facts among ourselves which are known to all. Passing over others, he will only remark that the impost so anxiously wished for by the public was defeated not by any of the larger states in the Union. Okay, GR, this is a cryptic paragraph.
Okay.
I think I understand what he's saying here, but what he's let me tell you what comes to mind. He's contrasting Great Britain to what we're intending to do.
Uh-huh.
And what he's saying is one of the weak points is that the smaller the body or area of government is, the more tendency it had to be either swayed or corrupted, whereas in our plan, the smaller the government, the better. Now, that's what I'm getting from this, but the rest of it, he's talking about things that have happened in the past that they all know, but we don't.
Yeah, right? So, okay. I'm looking at this as more of a theoretical, because he's talking in number two, Congress is a single legislature, and okay. So I think he's talking about the current Continental Congress. Despotism comes on mankind in different shapes, sometimes in an executive, sometimes in a military one. Is there no danger of a legislative despotism? Theory and practice both proclaim it. If the legislative authority be not restrained, there can be neither liberty nor stability, and it can only be restrained by dividing it within itself,
okay,
into distinct and independent branches. In a single house, there is no check, but the adequate one of the inadequate one of the virtue and good sense of those who compose it. So, right, and so actually, he's really talking, I think, about the importance of, you know, actually aggrandizing in one essence, or actually creating these different branches. Again, the New Jersey plan that they're contrasting had a single legislative body.
Mm-hmm.
And he was basically, so it's almost like, you know, you sit down and you kind of go through your head your own argument of, you know, the pros and cons of making a decision. And it sounds like he had the latitude of just standing up and speaking out loud of what his thoughts were, going through the pros and cons. And so
okay.
I think that some of these comments really, I think, drove home and actually kind of stimulated the minds and the spirits of everybody else in this convention to look for checks and balances, to look for things, because these guys were putting it all on the line. He was literally stating about the importance of having a balance or a check within the right. legislative. And it became the logical conclusion that having two separate and distinct legislative bodies was far better than the existing system of a single one.
Okay.
Anyway, on the other point, or on another great point, he goes on, the contrast was equally favorable to the plan reported by the Committee of the Whole. It vested the executive powers in a single magistrate. The plan of New Jersey vested them in a plurality in order to control the legislative authority. You must divide it. In order to control the executive, you must unite it. One man will be more responsible than three. Three will contend among themselves till one becomes the master of his colleagues. In the triumvirates of Rome, first Caesar, then Augustus, are witnesses of this truth. The kings of Sparta and the councils of Rome prove also factious consequences of dividing the executive magistracies. And so he goes on and finally says, having already taken up so much time, he proceeded to any other points, those on which he dealt with and so forth. So in other words, he just kind of said, okay, I'm done. but I'd be honest with you, when they're looking at the magistrates, and at this point in time, I just don't think that he was talking about the actual executive, the president himself.
Okay.
And so they didn't go ahead.
What then was he talking about?
Well, I really think that they're talking about the single magistrate and the plan of the, you know, having the two and having the one. Just like he said in the very beginning, it is my perception that he was really talking more of the legislative magistrate as the executive magistrate as well. Because at this point in time, the executive was, if I remember correctly, the executive presented by Virginia was a byproduct of the selection of the lower house in Congress. The lower house in Congress, they had not come up with an electoral college to create a okay. different check. So anyway, so Mr. Pinckney gets up and he basically okay. makes a comment, and then Mr. Ellsworth, so go ahead, pick that
okay,
up.
Okay, here we go. Mr. Pinckney, the whole comes to this, as he conceived. Give New Jersey an equal vote, and she will dismiss her scruples and concur in the national system. He thought the convention authorized to go any length in recommending which they found necessary to remedy the evils which produced this convention. That's interesting. So Mr. Pinckney certainly didn't believe that he was working outside of the convention, right?
Right. And so okay. actually, remember, Mr. Pinckney presented a plan.
Right.
And his plan wasn't even on the table.
But quick question.
Uh-huh.
Then he says this interesting, give New Jersey an equal vote and she will dismiss her scruples.
Uh-huh.
What does that mean?
What does that mean is give her an equal vote and she will no longer have, you know, well, the scruples are where you have to have compromise. The scruples are where you, you know, have to, you know, work with other people, where give New Jersey an equal vote, like Rhode Island, or give everybody an equal vote, and you're going to find that they're going to literally go down this path of, you know, using their power as their vote or what have you. Does that make sense?
It's
in other words, stopping, being obstinate, being the obstacle.
Rhode Island.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. All right, next.
Because we get, remember, New Jersey wanted to keep the plan the same. They were basically just saying, let's just stick with this. That was their plan of making really minor changes to the existing Continental Congress. So Mr. Ellsworth then speaks.
All right, Mr. Ellsworth proposed as a more distinctive form of collecting the mind of the committee on the subject, quote, that the legislative power of the United States should remain in Congress, end quote. This was not seconded, though it seemed better calculated for the purpose than the first proposition of Mr. Patterson, in place of which Mr. E wished to substitute it. I don't know who Mr. E is.
Ellsworth.
Okay. So, Mr. Randolph was not scrupulous on the point of power. When the salvation of the Republic was at stake, it would be treason to our trust not to propose what we found necessary. He painted in strong colors the imbecility of the existing Confederacy and the danger of delaying a substantial reform. In answer to the objection drawn from the sense of our constituents as denoted by their acts relating to the convention and the objects of their deliberation, he observed that as each state acted separately in the case, it would have been indecent for it to have charged the existing Constitution with all the vices which it might have perceived in it. The first state that set
now,
on
foot, just to be clear, the existing Constitution is the Articles of Confederation.
Correct. Okay. I understood that. Okay. Thanks for clarifying that. The first state that set on foot this experiment would not have been justified in going so far, ignorant as it was of the opinion of others, and sensible as it must have been of the uncertainty of a successful issue to the experiment. There are certainly seasons of a particular nature where the ordinary cautions must be dispensed with, and this is certainly one of them. He would not, as far as depended on him, leave anything that seemed necessary undone. The present moment is favorable and is probably the last that will offer. The true question is whether we shall adhere to the federal plan or introduce the national plan. The insufficiency of the former has been fully displayed by the trial already made.
Okay, so stop right here. He's obviously basically throwing the gauntlet down. If this is a tantrum, this might be Randolph's, you know, way of having a tantrum. He's basically saying that either we persist with the existing federal plan, because they're really pointing to this government as a national government.
Right.
And right now, you know, they have a Confederacy where they were calling that a federal plan, right? But actually, it wasn't a federation. It was a general government of the Confederation. Anyway, so he basically is saying, you know, we're being stupid. I mean, we're here for a reason, because that's not working. And what I'm hearing is there's enough people in this room that want to persist and keep going down this same path, you know, and I guess this a tantrum, or maybe he's just banging some heads together and saying, look, you know, have we forgotten why we're here? Keep going.
Okay.
Actually, we only have 10 seconds left. I really appreciate your time. And I know we really dove into a lot of this, but there's laying the groundwork of figuring out how they have to come together. And so, you know, the seeds are being planted, I think, by each of these men as they're saying, you know, one, we're going to have to move forward as Randolph is making the charge, because we know they do. And so it's not necessarily prophetic on my part at this point. But anyway, with that, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution?
To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org and let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.